Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello and welcome back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I'm your host, Robert Washburn, and you're listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. As long as there have been vaccines, there have been parents who have been concerned about getting their kids vaccinated. That is according to Professor Jennifer Reich, a sociologist at the University of Colorado, Denver. She has studied parental vaccine hesitancy in great depth. Her book, Calling the Shots: Why Parents Reject Vaccines, explores the history of vaccine hesitancy, going back to polio, smallpox, measles, and whooping cough. She has interviewed an incredible number of parents, caregivers, health officials, scientists, and others. Her most poignant work is being done in real time right now with the COVID-19 pandemic. She offers keen insight as she examines all the factors, medical, social, and political, as parents decide. Here is that interview. I'm so pleased to have with me today Jennifer Reich, professor of sociology at the University of Colorado, Denver, and the author of the book, Calling the Shots: Why Parents Reject Vaccines. Welcome to Consider This.
Thanks so much for having me.
Parents' concerns over vaccines is not new. Are you able to trace the roots of parental concerns with vaccines and where it started?
You know, we can look back and see that there were seeds of anti-vaccine sentiment as early as the very first smallpox vaccines. That as long as we've had vaccines, we've had questions about their safety and efficacy, and parents who express concerns about whether or not they want them for their children.
So how did parents been involved from very early on, but how did that evolve from concerns to the kinds of things that we see now, a cohesive movement? Can you trace that evolution as well for us?
You know, the earliest vaccine, anti-vaccine movements, even around smallpox, did have some social ties together with leaflets and campaigns. There was efforts in the US, for example, through the 1920s to revise and remove vaccine requirements against smallpox as part of a Red Scare, part of an anti-communist social movement. We've seen social movements over time. And it's worth noting, you know, here, and I think often, that vaccines are unique in a couple ways. So vaccines are given to healthy people to prevent the risk of illness, not to actually cure illness. And because of that, it creates really different sorts of questions for their usage. Vaccines have to be exquisitely safe to be acceptable because they're given to healthy people. And that's a really different standard than we see for other pharmaceutical products where, you know, we accept some increased risk to cure people because they're already sick. And so the standard for vaccines has always been really high. And that standard has to be stacked against whatever kind of risk there exists against illness and whether that risk is real and important and how it matters to families. So we can see historically that at different eras, there have been different kinds of ebbs and flows in enthusiasm and resistance to vaccines, and that much of that is focused on what's happening contextually, what's happening politically, what's happening socially, what's happening epidemiologically. You know, so polio vaccines, as an example, were in incredibly high demand when they were released. It was very clear, particularly in the US, that wealthy children had better access to vaccines than did low-income children, which drove new kinds of funding efforts and legislation to increase access to vaccines. But even as polio rates began declining, enthusiasm for the vaccine declined also. And so we see this kind of relationship to these multiple factors surrounding vaccines. It's also worth noting that although there's always been organized movements against vaccines, they've always been numerically very small. And so we think of it as really only a couple percent of the population at any time that is opposed to vaccines ideologically. And I make that distinction because when we talk about, you know, anti-vaxxers, which is a term I never use because it's not how people describe themselves. And so I don't think it really encompasses where people are coming from. But I have in my research spoken to people who believe vaccines are never necessary, some who argue they don't really work, I've talked to people who claim that, you know, polio went away by itself and the vaccine just got credit for it. There's absolute outliers around this question, but it's a numerically very small number. And truthfully, we can absorb a very small number of people who don't participate in public health. You know, a couple percent we can do. The challenge is that leading up to the COVID era, in the US, for example, we saw as many as 20 to 30% of American parents expressing a desire to skip vaccines, delay vaccines, and who were coming up with schedules of their own design that did not reflect vaccine science, and also were rejecting some vaccines altogether as because they found them uncompelling. And those people would never describe themselves as anti-vaccine. Instead, what they say is that they don't want these vaccines as recommended in the quantity and timing recommended. And they trust their own judgment when it comes to their family more than they trust that of experts. And that's a larger number. So when we get to 20 or 30% of people, they're not against vaccines ideologically, but the outcome might be the same, which is that they and their families may not be fully protected against infectious disease. And we know that that carries consequences for the community.
When I was researching this, there was a contrast between something called informed choice and being anti-vaccine. Can you explain the difference in perception around this?
Absolutely. So, you know, since the 1980s, the organizations that oppose vaccines, and what they really oppose is vaccine mandates and requirements for entry into schools or childcare settings or other civic spaces, have defined themselves not as opposed to vaccines, but pro-parents' rights and pro-informed consent. And rhetorically, that's really appealing because all of us are in favor of parents' rights and informed consent in healthcare. And the real modern era of those movements and that differentiation really came about in the 1980s. And it took the form as sort of a libertarian movement against government involvement in healthcare when it came to children and vaccines. And it started because there had been an early vaccine against pertussis that used a whole cell virus. And estimates are that there was about a 1 in a million chance of a child developing a seizure disorder, having brain swelling, or sometimes dying from this vaccine. Now, I'll acknowledge that there is robust disagreement in medical journals to this day over whether that was correlation or causation. In my research, I talked to a lot of people who work on vaccine injury lawsuits, and many of them said that at the time that the vaccine was reformulated, all of the claims of injury went away and they believe it was true. And so putting aside the correlation causation argument, even if we accept it's true, a small number of children were harmed by a vaccine. The outcome is that drove parents to begin talking to each other about their concerns. And it makes sense that it started in the 1980s because that was the same time what we had just seen in the prior decade, a robust women's health movement challenging childbirth, challenging patients' rights. We saw the early phases of social movements around HIV/AIDS acknowledgement and access to medications and dignity in healthcare. We saw a lot of ways that patients began pushing back on medical expertise. And so it makes sense that those early parents who began having conversations in living rooms started asking questions about medical authority and why it was that they were trusting experts without question. And that resonated with a lot of other things that were happening culturally at the time, including this increased emphasis on personalized healthcare and personal responsibility when it comes to your health. And so the growth of those conversations really laid the groundwork in pretty closely aligned ways to be able to say that parents are the ultimate decision makers when it comes to their kids. And we've seen this in education movements around the same time also. That individuals are responsible themselves for avoiding illness, so that they should be jogging or, you know, a decade later, counting their calories or counting their steps or avoiding carbohydrates or checking their DNA for underlining familial risk of illness or whatever we've seen since the 1980s till today around this idea that disease is individually manageable and that hard work can mitigate against disease. And the challenge, of course, with all of that is that none of that applies to infectious disease. that infectious disease is beyond individual control, which you're seeing in Ontario right now with Omicron, right? You're seeing it with the rollout of viruses where no matter what individuals do, they can't alone control infectious disease, that we are all tied together with infection. But knowing that around infectious disease doesn't actually resonate with the way we talk about what it means to be healthy. And so those kinds of movements really, really aligned around these other ideological threads about what does it mean to be a good parent? What does it mean to be a healthy person? What does it mean to take personal responsibility? And those align with a lot of neoliberal initiatives that we've seen in the US and Canada and the UK around this time period. They align with a lot of other kinds of themes that tie them together in a way that matches what, you know, what actually governments are telling us it means to be a good citizen. And in a lot of ways that really did sow the potential for declining enthusiasm and support for vaccines.
In your research, what do you find are the common reasons given for vaccine hesitancy?
Yeah, it's such an important question. You know, the overarching thing I find at the end of the day is that individuals want to feel seen as personalized, right? They want to feel that they are unique, their children are unique, and they want to be seen as unique within healthcare systems. And they see themselves as experts, that parents see themselves overwhelmingly as best able to make decisions for themselves and their children. And that they don't, it's not that they don't trust their pediatricians, but they see the pediatricians as one source of information amongst many. And that most physician encounters are about 15 minutes long once or twice a year. And that that's just not enough to understand the nuances within families. Getting a little bit more granular, the overarching things I see are that every parent I've spoken with, and this is true, I think, for adults making decisions about their own vaccines too, are participating in a process of evaluating risk and benefit. And they're evaluating their perceived risk of infection, which can include the likelihood of infection or exposure, and also the severity of illness should they become infected with a vaccine-preventable disease. And they're stacking that up against their perceived risks of the vaccine itself. And I will say that if we look at it mathematically, parents are inclined to overestimate the risk of an adverse reaction and underestimate the risk of infection, but that they see themselves as making this kind of individualized decision. And I talk to families that have different vaccine schedules for every child in their family based on their perceived risks and benefits. I talk to parents who recognize some vaccines might be more important for girls than boys. So for example, you know, measles and rubella can be devastating for fetal development. So they saw that maybe if their daughter hadn't encountered measles or rubella in childhood, maybe they would seek out a vaccine in adolescence or young adulthood to protect future pregnancies, but they didn't see those vaccines as important for boys, even as we can all recognize that boys are often around pregnant women and would prevent, you know, and could present a kind of risk. Parents frequently pointed to the fact that they didn't think chickenpox was a serious illness, and therefore the vaccine against varicella seemed unnecessary. They highlighted different kinds of strategies at different ages and the ways that there are more vaccines now than there were a generation ago. There's about twice as many vaccines as there was a generation ago. And that maybe they aren't all equally necessary or equally important. And also maybe there's too many and they question whether that could actually be safe. There's a lot of attention given to autism as a risk of vaccines, you know, following out of some of the debunked science from the 1990s. But what I actually heard more often from parents was not necessarily fear of autism, although it did sometimes come up, but I more often heard fear of autoimmune diseases that are hard to explain. So we know at a population level, rates of things like multiple sclerosis have increased or lupus have increased, and no one's really clear why. I think the leading theories have to do with environmental factors and perhaps like increased use of plastics and bioidentical, you know, chemicals that mimic hormones, but there's no real clear answers. And so parents said to me, well, how do we know acting on the infant immune system isn't the reason? And you know, it's really hard to argue about causality for two events that happened 40 years apart. And so it becomes really hard to reassure. And there, from that perspective, then many parents saw omission as safer than commission. that skipping something or waiting to see feels cautious, and that if you're not afraid of infection or you don't think your child is the one who will be decimated by measles because you trust in your hard work as a parent around nutrition and caregiving, then the measles vaccine comes to feel more scary than the disease itself.
The anti-vax movement among parents is growing, especially during COVID-19. Can you describe the messaging and explain why it is appealing?
I'll just confess that one of the things that happened early in the pandemic when in the US, for example, President Trump announced Operation Warp Speed as this initiative to develop a vaccine quickly, I became very concerned because it wasn't just about the COVID vaccines. What I saw in the making in, April 2020, was the possibility that a badly communicated vaccine process would undermine confidence in all vaccines. And that's unfortunately, I think, what's happening. So some of the threads that existed before COVID included distrust of pharmaceutical companies and also distrust of the regulation of those companies. So in other words, people were not convinced that government agencies were adequately evaluating the claims and science of pharmaceutical companies, and that we're too often partnering in ways that we talk about public-private partnerships as a good thing. Operation Warp Speed in the US is an example of literally giving millions and millions of dollars to for-profit company to develop science. And again, you can look at that and say, isn't it great if we fully fund science, we can get, you know, amazing things can happen. You could also look at that and say, how rigorously would the government be regulating that, having invested financially in all in these processes, right? So it was this opportunity where I saw the importance of clear communication about that regulation process and what that was going to mean. And so that's really been a challenge. I'd say the other things that are really interesting to think about, and these are the things I spend a lot of time thinking about, is that we don't have a strong culture of vaccines for adults at all. And so, you know, in the US, vaccine against influenza is recommended for everybody over, you know, even infants and young children. I know in Canada, the recommendations are different, where, you know, it's encouraged for adults over, you know, adults who are at higher risk of complication, which means most adults don't get very many vaccines. College students sometimes are asked to participate in meningitis vaccines or things that are direct risk. There's new vaccines against shingles, which is a holdover from those of us who had chickenpox as children who still have the virus in our bodies. But those vaccines are not widely used. They are, you know, in the US, 26% of adults got a shingles vaccine, and they're recommended for everyone over the age of 50 here. And so we don't really have a strong culture of adults getting vaccines, which meant that the COVID vaccine rollout was already going to have to overcome that sense of that challenge, in particular of convincing adults that they're people who want vaccines and need vaccines. And that was an easy sell for people over 65 or 70 because the data were so clear that they were at the greatest risk of the worst outcomes of infection. And that's also a population that gets flu vaccines, that gets other kind, gets pneumococcal vaccines. So for healthy working age adults, this was a mismatch to what we already do culturally. Additionally, there were questions about that, back to that risk benefit analysis. So what I saw early on was that, and we're still facing that young adults are the lowest users of COVID vaccines. And it's not surprising for all the reasons I heard parents say they didn't want to vaccinate their children also, which is that they're healthy, they have good nutrition, they're not likely to be the ones most decimated by an illness. And in the same way parents explained to me how measles wasn't their biggest concern, we're hearing similar things about COVID vaccines for young adults and now for children as well. And how do, you know, and if children are not the most likely to be the most seriously affected by COVID infection, why vaccinate them against it if you're not 100% certain the vaccine is entirely safe and effective? And that same calculation people are engaging in has a great deal to do with how individuals perceive risk and benefit to themselves.
So far, we have not seen any protests at schools locally. But we just began doing vaccinations earlier this week. We have seen escalating rhetoric, though, and actions elsewhere where some parents are campaigning under the banner of protecting children. How do you react to some of the messaging and the politicization of COVID vaccines and protocols for kids?
For COVID vaccines?
Yes.
In particular?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's really, COVID vaccines for children are a really interesting question. You know, on one hand, we can say, well, children are most likely to be asymptomatic or have mild illness, and that therefore it's not a priority to vaccinate them. And that's a conversation worth having. And it depends what we think is reasonable. You know, COVID is still one of the top 10 killers of children in the last year, because children don't die. Children very seldomly get hospitalized compared to adults. And so what's our tolerable level to risk is really important to ask. What's also not totally clear, if we're going to think about vaccines as a personal benefit, is what's the long story of infection? So it turns out there's many viruses that affect you severely decades after you're infected. So we can think about post-polio syndrome that shows up in later adulthood. Measles has an unfortunate complication that can lead to, causes untreatable brain damage that will kill you more than a decade after infection, that can also wipe out your immune system's memory of other viruses. So we know viruses can often act in complicated ways after a person has seemingly recovered, and we don't know about SARS-CoV-2 yet. We are still all learning in real time what the virus is capable of. What we do know is a significant number of children who have seemingly, you know, are over infection or have recovered are still experiencing some number of symptoms. And that rate seems to be significant for children who experience multi-system inflammation syndrome, which is a complication that requires at least two organs to fail and hospitalization as a diagnostic criteria for that. And MISC, multi-system inflammation syndrome in children, has affected thousands of children, and a significant number of them are still experiencing symptoms more than 6 months later. And so we have some real questions to ask. What does it mean when children experience organ failure in childhood? What does that mean for their long-term health? And those are questions that we'll know the answer to, and getting those answers are going to cost us a great deal in terms of lost health for children. All of those answers, though, are individual personal benefit answers, right? What's the risk to children and what's the benefit to children? And I think that those are important because individuals should know how they are personally benefiting if they're absorbing some risk. But we also have to think about what does it mean if children are part of communities, just as it matters that adults are part of communities. As an aside, what I'll say is that one of the saddest things for me during the COVID era was how little adults were willing to sacrifice to make sure children were safe and healthy. And that included having access to their schools, right? There was an opportunity to say we could close bars or restaurants, or adults could do things differently to make sure children could continue to be in school and learn in person. And that's not what happened. Those were not the decisions that were made. And children are suffering in significant ways. From lost opportunities to be together, but also in terms of depression and anxiety that are approaching record levels. I also think we have to remember that even if it's not about the infection itself, young people are struggling emotionally, and many young people are struggling with the possibility that they could infect people they care about and that they love, and that is a huge burden that young people have been carrying with them throughout the pandemic. And I talk to young people all the time who can't make decisions about when to go to school or when to come to college classes, when to go home again, without feeling like they're introducing new risk to their family. And vaccines are also a kind of containment strategy for those fears. And that's important to acknowledge. But when it comes to infectious disease, we can't solve this solely as a personal benefit. Everyone who wants vaccines should get them. People who don't want them don't. I heard this from parents all the time. If you think vaccines work, you should get them for your kids. My decision, if vaccines work, how do my kids present a risk to your kids? And that came up over and over again. And the answers are complicated and also easy, because we know vaccines don't work for everybody. Some people can get a vaccine and they don't gain full protection. We know some people cannot be vaccinated because they're too young, or they've lost immune memory, or they've experienced a chronic illness that's compromised their immune system. We know that viruses mutate, and we're watching this right now in real time as we're all, and I know Ontario now is up to, I think, 4 cases as of today of Omicron, and thinking about what do new variants mean, and new variants emerge because viruses are able to replicate inside of bodies. And the more we can limit viral replication, the better off we are in protecting against future variants. And so, you know, having a personal strategy for vaccines is not going to get us out of a pandemic, and it's not going to protect everyone in the community unless we acknowledge the ways that we're all tied together and that that's unavoidable. And that's where the governments get to sometimes have a say, which, and when I say governments, it sounds like they're separate, but that's where the people get a say. That's where communities get to say together whether we have standards to make sure that the most vulnerable among us are also safe. And those are where those conversations occur.
Can you give any advice to parents, grandparents, families, and health officials to help them navigate these decisions in the upcoming days and weeks?
I think the starting point is that we are all exhausted. Those immunized and those not immunized, we are all tired. And this has been a very hard 2 years. And we are fatigued. We are drained. We've all experienced loss in different ways. Some of us have lost family members and friends. Some of us have lost opportunities. Some of us have lost educational experiences. We've all experienced loss. And it's a hard place to start hard conversations is when everyone's already struggling. What I will say is that no one has ever changed their minds about vaccines when called ignorant, stupid, or anti-science. So that's just not a productive place to start. And often it's really hard if you believe strongly in your perspective to hear where others are coming from. But what I find over and over again in my research is that the people who reject vaccines are not doing so out of malice. They're doing so because their examination of their perceptions of the risk and benefit at an individual level have driven them to this decision. And starting from that place of hearing where they're coming from, hearing what they fear, hearing how they've understood the risks of vaccines against the risk of illness, and having conversations about whether their information is still drawing on the most recent scientific knowledge and what it means to be part of a community can often be persuasive in small ways. We also have to acknowledge, though, that sometimes that individuals should always be entitled and empowered to make their own healthcare decisions, but that may come with consequences. It may come with the inability to attend certain spaces or to see shows or participate in civil society in different ways, because sometimes the cost of participation is the protection of those around us, just like we have stop signs and laws for other kinds of public safety that we all have to adhere to, even at personal cost. Vaccines and infectious disease prevention are another one of those spaces where individuals have to also consider the risks and benefits for employment and for education and for other spaces, travel, dining, whatever it is, to make sure that all members in the community can be safe.
Jennifer Reich, thank you so much for talking to me today.
It was my pleasure.
That was Professor Jennifer Reich, a sociologist at the University of Colorado, Denver. I want to thank my guests this week for talking to me, and I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening and stay tuned for more from Consider This.